is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the author of The Misquotable C.S. Lewis. On the show today, I'm featuring highlights from the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium from Taylor University. Specifically, today's show features portions from the keynote talks by Stephen Prickett and Charlie Starr. However, before getting to those highlights, I have a special treat for you. While at the Taylor Colloquium, I spoke with several students who were attending, and I asked them about their experience. That's what you hear first. Then I'll share about 10 minutes each of Stephen Prickett's and Charlie Starr's keynote addresses. During each of their talks, I want to let you know, they did reference some visuals they used, but the parts I'm sharing will still make sense without seeing them. So again, first up, you hear from some students. I had them give their first name, some background information, and what they enjoyed about the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium at Taylor University. This segment is about 7 minutes, so the keynote highlights follow after them.
Christine, Azusa Pacific University, class of 2018. I just graduated in May. My major is Honors Humanities and Business Management. And the thing I enjoy the most is C.S. Lewis. He's who I was first introduced to, so I'm still studying his works, and I haven't moved on to others yet, but I'm definitely looking forward to doing that in the future. And my expectations before coming to Taylor were getting to network with other people also interested in the Inklings, and I was just very excited to share my presentation, so I was looking forward to being able to tell people about that. But my expectations were definitely exceeded. The community here was more than I expected, and just getting to talk with other people about their research and hearing how excited they were about their own projects. I think it was a really special community, and I was really honored to be a part of it. So a few highlights from this colloquium that come to mind are just really getting to talk to people who have studied Lewis for years and getting to speak with the keynote speakers and just hear what they have shared from their years of study. And definitely looking forward to continuing on these relationships and conversations in the future and coming back in 2 years.
Morgan, Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm going into my sophomore year. I'm a software engineering major. I enjoy reading C.S. Lewis the most. My expectations before I came in were just learning more about the scholarly research that's gone into all of C.S. Lewis's friends. It's something that is all new to me, so I was looking forward to all of it. And on that same note, my expectations were so far exceeded, getting to know these people who absolutely love what they're doing has been amazing for me, and I've learned so much about such amazing authors. A few highlights that come to my mind are meeting Stephen Prickett. It was so cool seeing someone who had actually been with Lewis before, even if it was somewhat limited. He was just an amazing person to learn from, as well as Dr. Charlie Starr. I loved getting to talk with him and just experiencing the scholars and having their encouragement was honestly a life-changing experience.
Allison, I'm from Seattle Pacific University, and I'm just finishing my junior year, going to be entering into my final year. My major is English creative writing with an emphasis in fiction. Inklings that I probably enjoy the most would definitely be both C.S. Lewis and Tolkien. I've read Lord of the Rings recently, and that was kind of my first exposure to the series, but I'm like a fantasy type fiction writer, so I love the way that Tolkien's able to create such complex worlds that fit together in such a great way. My expectations coming to this conference, I didn't really know what to expect since I'm from Seattle. I've never been to Indiana before. I just kind of figured like it'd be a bunch of like C.S. Lewis, Tolkien nerds coming together and talking about a lot of their works. And so I was very surprised to find that there were so many other authors that were being talked about, like Dorothy Sayers, MacDonald. I had never really been familiar with either of them. So I definitely learned a lot about other Inklings and just writers in general that I was not familiar with before. My expectations were definitely met at this conference. I met so many great people. I learned so much, and it was just great being an undergraduate student to just be in the presence of so many just great scholars who have been looking at these different authors and works for so many years. And so I was definitely humbled to be able to be here and also to present my paper. I would say some highlights for me would just be, like I said, just getting to meet so many different people, networking for like a young person who's just kind of starting off thinking about career paths. It was great to just talk to so many different people. And I also really enjoyed the faith element of the conference, just being around people who are both scholars and Christians and just kind of being able to work with those two together and be academic and also growing in one's faith was a really good highlight for me as well. So I loved the conference and I would love to come back again. And presenting was a great experience also, and I think a platform for me to really dive deeper into these authors and my academic goals in general.
My name is Anna. I am from Oral Roberts University. I actually just graduated, and I will be heading to the University of St. Andrews to begin a degree in Romantic and Victorian Literature. I really enjoy reading C.S. Lewis. I always have since I was really young, although I think currently my favorite is actually Charles Williams, just because I find his novels very thrilling and very engaging. And when I was coming here, I kind of had pre-expectations based on the last conference that I was at. I was at the C.S. Lewis Society conference at Oral Roberts last year, and so I kind of knew a little bit about the Inkling scholarship community already, and I was really pleased upon coming here to find that everything that I had found last time was actually still true, and even more so, there's just such a very friendly environment, a very welcoming and a really well-connected environment where everybody is very willing to work with each other, to talk about each other's work. I've been so pleased by how supportive everybody has been towards the undergraduates and even the graduate students who maybe are not as fully into Lewis scholarship. And I myself am not a huge Inkling scholar. And so just that people are still interested and still find so many connections to my own work, I think it's just really exciting and very enjoyable. One of the best highlights of the colloquium was speaking to Kirsten Jeffrey Johnson. She was really friendly, and she had so many great comments about my work in the Victorian period and relating that to MacDonald and showing me kind of what I could do and where I could go, and that was really exciting to me.
Here's Stephen Prickett, Regius Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Glasgow and president of the George MacDonald Society.
There is, I expect, nobody in this room who is not aware of the Inklings' debt to their Victorian predecessors, to writers like Lewis Carroll, Charles Kingsley, William Morris, and perhaps above all to George MacDonald. That's why you're here. In the case of C.S. Lewis, we know about this debt because he told us about it in some detail. Yet, ever since March the 4th, 1916, when the 18-year-old Clive Staples Lewis picked up a copy of Phantastes on Leatherhead Railway Station bookstall, biographers of both writers have been slightly puzzled by what exactly was being acknowledged. At a first reading, Lewis's account of the event seems utterly lucid in its exact recall. Turning to a bookstall, I picked out an Everyman in a Dirty Jacket, Phantastes, a Fairy Romance, George MacDonald. Then the train came in. I can still remember the voice of the porter calling out the village names, Saxon and sweet as a nut, Bookham, Effingham, Horsley Train. That evening, I began reading my new book. Some 10 years before, in his preface to George MacDonald, an anthology, published in 1946, Lewis tells us a little more. In particular, that he'd looked at that volume on the bookstall and rejected it on a dozen previous occasions. Even then, though Lewis apparently bought it as train reading, by his own account, were you listening to that one, he didn't begin to read it until he got to his destination, even though the names of the stations he passed through afterwards apparently came to radiate in the afterglow of that delayed subsequent reading. The effect of the encounter with MacDonald is described in terms no less lucid and articulate. And it's a fairly long quotation, so I've put it up so that you can, because I intend to double back on little bits of it. The woodland journeyings in that story, the ghostly enemies, the ladies, both good and evil, were close enough to my habitual imagery to lure me on without the perception of a change. It is as if I were carried sleeping across the frontier, or as if I had died in the old country and could never remember how I came alive in the new. I did not yet know, and I was long in learning, the name of this new quality, the bright shadow that rested on the travels of Anodos. I do now. It was holiness. There was no temptation to confuse the scenes of the tale with the light that rested on them, or to suppose they were put forward as realities, or even to dream that they had been realities, and I could reach the woods where Anodos journeyed. I should thereby come a step nearer to my desire. Thus, when the great moments came, I did not break away from the woods and cottages that I read of to seek some bodiless light shining beyond them. For I now perceived that while the air of the new region made all my erotic and magical perversions of joy look like stupid, sordid trumpery, it had no such disenchanting power over the bread upon the table or the coals in the grate. That was the marvel. Up until now, each visitation of joy, remember, note the quotation from Wordsworth, had left the common world momentarily a desert. Even when real clouds or trees had been the material of the vision, they had been so only by reminding me of another world, and I did not like the return to ours. But now I saw the bright shadow coming out of the book into the real world and resting there, transforming all common things, and yet itself unchanged. Sorry, there's a second bit there. This deliberately Wordsworthian account is so articulate, so poetic, that it's easy to miss just how odd this statement actually is. To begin with, the future Oxford Don was already familiar and comfortable with the incidental paraphernalia of fairyland, ghosts, giants, goblins, etc., in a way that few of us will ever be. Moreover, what he seems to be trying to describe in this passage, whether retrospective or not, is very far from the normal use of the word holiness. The holy, we recall, describes something separate, special, set apart from the mundane, or what would later come to be called the secular. It is, therefore, all the stranger that Lewis, who knew no one better by 1930 the derivation and implications of the word, seems determined here to blur the very boundaries between the sacred and the secular that the word holy has originally defended. But we must remember, of course, what he records here took place just after he declared himself an atheist at the age of 15. This whole event took place some 16 years before his acknowledged reconversion to Christianity in 1929-31. So that what he's describing is something entirely retrospective. As he freely admits in that passage I've just quoted, the 16-year-old Lewis, the recently declared atheist, would never have used words like holiness to describe that bright shadow that transformed his mundane world. Indeed, the whole idea that Lewis was in some way converted by reading Phantastes simply cannot be correct as it stands. Only in retrospect did MacDonald's novel acquire that aura of sanctity with which he later endowed it. The account I've just quoted from is from Surprised by Joy, published in 1955, almost 40 years after the event itself, by which time it had acquired for Lewis a totally new meaning. Any account of Lewis and Phantastes must, therefore, be in terms of a historical reinterpretation over much of Lewis's life, a reinterpretation, one should add, that he was only too willing to contribute to. Hints of this ongoing process of rewriting his past are to be found scattered throughout Lewis's writings, From his earliest major work of fiction, Pilgrim's Regress, published in 1933 when he was in his mid-30s, to the sermon The Weight of Glory, delivered in Oxford 10 years later. As he makes clear, this is not so much nostalgia as existential theory. What he came to see as central to his religious experience is a kind of longing, a desire for something not quite tangible, but simultaneously infinitely more real than the things which aroused that longing. As a professor of literature, one might expect that this was a kind of literary experience, and so it seems to have been for the rebellious teenager. But Lewis was careful later to insist that it was not so. "In reading great literature," he wrote, "I become a thousand men, and yet I remain myself. Like the night sky in the Greek poem, I see with a myriad eyes, but it is still I who see. Here, as in worship, in love, in moral action, and in knowing, I transcend myself, and am never more myself than when I do." But literature is only a halfway house. Powerful as such an aesthetic response is, what Lewis is reaching after is something more, and it's a fundamental category mistake to confuse one with the other. "The university study of English literature," he once wrote, "directs to the study of literature a great many talented, ingenious, and diligent people whose real interests are not specifically literary at all. Forced to talk about books, what can they do but try and make books into the sort of thing they can talk about? Hence, literature becomes for them a religion, a philosophy, a school of ethics, a psychotherapy, a sociology, anything other than a work of art." It's precisely because he does value works of art that he insists they should not be read in terms of other values. As with Thomas Traherne, whom I suspect Lewis may be echoing here, aesthetics is a surrogate, a metonymy. Even in seeking to frame his experience of Phantastes in terms of an aesthetic description, he's already moving beyond that. Indeed, he is clearly and quite consciously using aesthetics to describe something that is not really aesthetic at all. When, again, he writes of that unnameable something, desire for which pierces us like a rapier at the smell of a bonfire, the sound of wild ducks flying overhead, the title of The Well at the World's End, the opening lines of Kubla Khan, the morning cobwebs inside, Anodos' own death. None of these would seem to me to be particularly redolent of holiness in any sense of the word that I would recognize.
I hope you enjoyed this portion of Stephen Prickett's keynote address. It's just an example of the excellent speakers you can hear when attending the Lewis and Friends Colloquium at Taylor University. At the time of this recording, the next one is scheduled for 2020. Be sure to check the show notes of this podcast. It'll give you links to the Center for the Study of C.S. Lewis and Friends website and the Colloquium's website. I'll give you more information about how to find those show notes at the end of the podcast. Now here's a segment from Charlie Starr's keynote address that is adapted from his fascinating book, The Fawn's Bookshelf, C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters.
I want to look at the most difficult part of Lewis's theory of myth, about myth and knowledge, about the relationship among a series of ideas, myth, truth, reality, and meaning. So we're going light tonight, okay? Mythic meaning, you see, represents something which once grasped is absolutely astounding, a mystery which ultimately explains the power of myth and its continued influence on our world today. What is it about myth that attracts us so? Think of it like this. In terms of literary periods, the 20th century was called modernism, eventually shifting into the postmodern, and was a direct child of realism. Modern literature relies heavily on the realistic, but if we consider what was the most successful book of the century and the most successful film series, we encounter the mystery of myth. Tom Shippey argued pretty successfully that Tolkien's Lord of the Rings was the novel of the last century, much to the dismay of critics. And I think we can make a similar argument, whether we want to or not, for George Lucas's Star Wars films. These texts both embraced and balked at the aesthetic of the day, adopting a kind of hyper-realism in method, but within environments and contents that were utterly fantastic. More importantly, in the case of both creators, these texts were deliberately written to make new myths for the 20th century. It worked, as their success shows, proving the power of myth. But what is that power? Where does it come from? Here's my short answer. Myth represents a mode of perception and thought which carries us back to Eden and forward to paradise. And now I had better explain what I mean by that. So let's take a look at what I'm calling part one, meaning, imagination, and truth, which we start with a scene from Star Wars. In order to understand mythic thought, we have to talk more about more than just myth. We have to talk about meaning. What does it mean is a question we ask all the time, often about symbols and images we encounter in books, songs, and movies. But do we ever ask what meaning means? Usually when we ask for the meaning of a word, a line in a song, or a symbolic image, we want an explanation in words. My favorite example of this comes from a movie-watching experience with my daughter. In The Empire Strikes Back, Luke journeys down into his cave of knowledge and confronts Darth Vader. He cuts Vader's head off to find his own face looking back at him. My daughter watched that movie with me when she was around 10 years old and asked me what that scene meant. So I told her, it means Luke's worst enemy is himself. He has to fight his own fear and doubt before he can face the real Darth Vader. What happened in the cave was a dream or a vision. So I explained the meaning in words. But movies mean more than the words in them. Their magic is in the meanings they communicate beyond words. Their truth is in their images and experiential quality. The scene doesn't even have words in it, right? In an essay called Bluspels and Phalansferies, I just love saying that, Lewis helps us search for the meaning of meaning. At the end of a long discussion on metaphor, meaning, and imagination, Lewis says that he's not trying to argue that imagination is the organ of truth. He hasn't been talking about truth, but about meaning, which is the antecedent condition both of truth and falsehood. The opposite of meaning isn't falsehood, but nonsense. However, it's only by the meaning-making ability of imagination that either truth or falsehood are possible. Lewis concludes that reason is the natural organ of truth, imagination is the organ of meaning. This is important because Lewis associates myth with imagination. In The Pilgrim's Regress, he specifically writes that myth must be grasped with the imagination, not with the intellect. Elsewhere, he says, it is imagination that makes myth. And again, the mythopoeic is a mode of imagination which does something to us at a deep level. Myth and imagination are connected in Lewis's thinking, but they are not the same thing. Lewis's simplest definition of imagination occurs in Miracles. He says we can imagine, that is, we can cause to exist the mental pictures of material objects and even human characters and events. According to Peter Skakel, Lewis uses the term imagination in several ways. As the image-making power, the creative or inventive power, the power to make up things, the power to create fiction, the mysteriousness and adventurousness of romance, and the imagination in a higher Coleridgean sense, a sense in which imagination is seen as a key to perception, creativity, knowledge, and encounters with the transcendent. For Coleridge, it had nothing less than spiritual significance. And while that last definition of imagination is important, the most basic definition may be more important to our initial understanding of myth. In our imaginations, we are able to mimic experience. And we can do this not only by repeating experiences through memory, but by inventing whole new experiences. These can include experiences we've never been through ourselves and magical, fantastical experiences which no one has been through except in their imagination. To encounter myth, then, is not to encounter truth or a series of truths so much as it is to encounter an experience or experiences. This doesn't mean there's no connection between myth and truth, but it's very important that we get right what that connection actually is. In Blessables, the imagination provides meaning which can make it possible for reason to find truths. But as we add experience into the mix of understanding, especially the experience of myth, things get a little bit more complicated. Though Lewis finds myth to contain kernels of truth, gleams of divine inspiration, he also acknowledges, however briefly, that among the myth-making influences in our world are demonic ones. Another potential problem with myth is the fact that we encounter it in the imagination. In a rare warning about myth, Lewis writes that myth is made by imagination, and imagination only uses elements from rational thought which it finds convenient. In the Blessables essay, Lewis notes that without meaning there can be neither truths nor falsehoods, but then we have to see the epistemological implications of this idea, something Lewis scholars writing about myth and imagination, including myself, haven't sufficiently addressed until recently. While Lewis's theory of myth suggests the relationship between imagination and truth is important, he nevertheless sees this limitation, that the imagination can be used for relating meanings that are false as well as true. In short, the imagination can be used as a vehicle to propagate lies. Lewis points this out in several works, which I detail in my book, but for Lewis, imagination serves a dual role. As the faculty of meaning, it can be used to foster lies, but also truth. But in short, if the imagination can be fooled, and if myths come to us through imagination, then clearly there are some limits to the knowledge myth can bring us. That said, Lewis believes that myth has a complex relationship with truth, and a very real one, one worth putting in some effort to understand, one which acknowledges imagination as an avenue to truths which can't be approached in any way except by imagination. So the imagination can cause us some real problems and lead us down some paths toward falsehood, but Lewis would say there are some truths that simply can't be apprehended except through imaginative means. One way Lewis deals with the complicated connection between myth and truth is in discussing the relationship between poetry and theology. In his essay, Is Theology Poetry?, Lewis notes that the imagination loves to do two things. First, it loves to embrace its object completely, to take it in at a single glance and see it as something harmonious, symmetrical, and self-explanatory. Secondly, it enjoys losing itself in a labyrinth, to surrender to the inextricable. And this is something theology does not easily do. To ask if theology is only poetry is to ask if it is merely mythological in the worst sense of that word. And here Lewis makes a key distinction between imaginative enjoyment and intellectual assent. From the 1300s to the 1800s, roughly, Christian Europe delighted in Greek and Roman mythologies without believing in them on a theological level. And modern poets have a love for the beauty of Greek mythology, according to Lewis, which the Greeks themselves couldn't match. Lewis is attempting to draw his audience to a distinction between believing a thing to be true and enjoying an imaginative experience, what he calls an aesthetic effect. These activities of the mind are not the same and are not automatically joined to each other. Aesthetic enjoyment, though it may have some relation to intellectual agreement, isn't the same thing as intellectual agreement. What happens when we reason, what happens when we imagine, are different things. Lewis emphasizes this point in his essay, Horrid Red Things. He tells the story of overhearing a conversation between a woman and her daughter, where the woman told her daughter, don't take too many aspirins. If you did, they would be poisonous. But the little girl replies, but why? If you break them open, they don't have any horrid red things inside them. What was immediately clear was that the girl had a false image of what poison looks like. At the same time, however, she had a true understanding that poison could kill or harm. She had the right idea, but the wrong image. Recall Screwtape's ploy that the devil can't possibly be real, because after all, who could believe in a creature in red tights with horns and a pitchfork? You can see the mistake in the thinking. The statement argues against an unbelievable image of the devil, not against the idea of a fallen angel who considers God his greatest enemy. Lewis summarizes the point. What you think is one thing, what you imagine while you are thinking is another. Lewis is more emphatic on the point in Miracles, where he notes that clear thinking can be accompanied by imagining, which is ludicrously false. But this doesn't mean they can't be connected. In fact, to the contrary. Lewis extends his epistemological argument in Miracles, noting that while images may be false, in the case of dealing with anything that is not sensory, we must use imaginative language.
Again, you've just been listening to Lewis scholar Charlie Starr from a keynote address he gave at the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium at Taylor University. I did an interview with Charlie about his book, from which this talk was based on. Check the show notes for a link to that podcast. And be sure to catch the other special shows that I have or will be releasing featuring highlights from other keynote speakers and more. As they are posted, I'll update the show notes for this program. You can get those show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. Alternatively, you could go to where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. And in case you didn't know, you can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. If you don't know how to do that, the show notes will help you to get to there because it has a direct link. Finally, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host for All About Jack. In addition to my new book for 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis, I have an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters that is entitled C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell.